Those are sounds made by a female bonobo, but it was the ability of the great apes to understand human language that captured the imagination of novelist Sarah Gruen. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. Sarah Gruen's new novel is called Ape House, and it was inspired by her encounters with the bonobos who live at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. Today, we'll talk with her about her book and about the remarkable creatures at the center of the plot. We'll also be talking with William Fields, scientific director of the Great Ape Trust, about our endangered wild cousins and what we can learn about bonobos and human beings from the apes' ability to understand the spoken word and communicate through American Sign Language and symbols. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after this news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A family of bonobos are at the center of the plot in Sarah Gruen's new novel, Ape House. These bonobos live at a research facility in Kansas where they are taught to communicate through American Sign Language and through the use of symbols. It's also clear that at least some of the apes understand the spoken word. This family of apes is patterned after a group of bonobos who live at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. And later on this hour, William Fields, the director of scientific research at the Great Ape Trust, will join our conversation. And you're welcome to join as well at 866-780-9100. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And with me now is Sarah Gruen, the author of Ape House. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm okay, thank you.
Animals have played an important role in all of your novels. This is your fourth novel. What gave you the idea to write about bonobos?
Right before I was going to go on tour for my last book, Water for Elephants, I got an email that contained a link to the Great Ape Trust's website, and I was doubly fascinated because I have had a lifelong fascination with the language capabilities of apes, and I had also never heard of bonobos. And so within a couple of days of looking into it, I realized that this just really had to be the setting for my next novel.
When you were looking at that website and looking at the different projects that were done at the Great Ape Trust, what was it that really captured your imagination?
I think the bonobos themselves, because they have such a very different culture than other great apes. And in fact, were not even recognized as a species of their own until, I think, 1928. They were just considered a subspecies of chimpanzee. But their culture is matriarchal, egalitarian, very nonviolent. It's a peaceable group. And that just really fascinated me.
I was just going to say, for people who don't know what bonobos are, haven't ever seen them differentiated from chimpanzees, why or what are they like, and why do you think, and why do many people feel that they're so important to human beings?
They DNA-wise are equidistant to us as chimpanzees are, and they look similar to chimpanzees, but they have black faces, pink lips. They have a very distinctive hairstyle. It's black hair parted down the center. They're a little bit smaller than chimpanzees. They have longer, I hesitate to say this, but more elegant limbs than chimpanzees. They look like the ballet dancer of the ape world.
I would love for you to read me just a little bit of your book. Toward the beginning of the book, John Thickpin, who is a journalist in your book and one of the main characters, visits this research facility in Kansas that is very similar to the Great Ape Trust. And after he leaves, he's reflecting on what he has seen and learned that first day. And I'd love for you to read that for me.
Sure. John and Osgood exchanged a silent, relieved glance when they got their seat assignments for the trip home. John didn't know Osgood's take on today's experience. They hadn't had a moment alone. But for John, something massive had shifted. He'd had a two-way conversation with great apes. He'd spoken to them in English, and they'd responded using American Sign Language, all the more remarkable because it meant they were competent in two human languages. One of the apes, Bonzi, arguably knew three. She was able to communicate by computer using a specially designed set of lexigrams. John also hadn't realized the complexity of their native tongue. During the visit, the bonobos had clearly demonstrated their ability to vocalize specific information, such as flavors of yogurt and locations of hidden objects, even when unable to see each other. He looked into their eyes and recognized without a shadow of doubt that sentient, intelligent beings were looking back. It was entirely different from peering into a zoo enclosure, and it changed his comprehension of the world in such a profound way he could not yet articulate it. Being cleared by Isabel Duncan was only the first step in getting inside the apes' living quarters. After Kat's banishment to Blake Hall, Osgood and John were taken into an administrative office to wait while the apes were consulted. John had been told ahead of time that the bonobos had final say over who came into their home, and also that they'd been known to be fickle. Over the past 2 years, they'd allowed in only about half of their would-be visitors. Knowing this, John had stacked his odds as much as possible. He researched the bonobos' tastes online and bought a backpack for each, which he stuffed with favorite foods and toys. Bouncy balls, fleece blankets, xylophones, Mr. Potato Heads, snacks, and anything else he thought they might find amusing. Then he emailed Isabel Duncan and asked her to tell the bonobos he was bringing surprises. Despite his efforts, John found that his forehead was beaded with sweat by the time Isabel returned from the consultation and informed him that not only were the apes allowing Osgood and him to come in, they were insisting. She led them into the observation area, which was separated from the apes by a glass partition. She took the backpacks, disappeared into a hallway, reappeared on the other side of the glass, and handed them to the apes. John and Osgood stood watching as the bonobos unpacked their gifts. John was so close to the partition, his nose and forehead were touching it. He'd almost forgotten it was there, so when the M&Ms surfaced and Bonzi leapt up to kiss him through the glass, he nearly fell backward.
That's Sarah Gruen reading from her novel Ape House. And Sarah, how similar is that to the first experience you had when you went to the Great Ape Trust?
It's pretty darn close. I really did want to see them, and so I packed. I knew that all of them love M&Ms, and I knew that Kanzi's favorite food was green onions, and Pambinacia's were boiled eggs and so on, and that Pambinacia likes rubber snakes. And I packed all of the backpacks identically, but I did make sure that everybody's favorite thing was represented.
And when they were asked if you could come in, did the same thing happen? They insisted that you come in with your presents?
That's what I was told.
That's wonderful. Tell me about that first communication you had with one of the apes.
The first ape that I met was Kanzi, and he's the oldest male there,
and the most famous.
Rock star.
Yeah,
he knows it too. He came out, and the first thing he did was slide across the floor and display and bang into walls, and it's a way of showing his status, and it's very impressive to watch. But he's also very eager to show his language competence and is not shy at all. He assumes that everybody adores him, which they do. The second ape that I met was Pambinacia, who is at least as language competent as her brother and possibly even more so. But she's shyer, or at least she holds herself back until she's sure of you. And I had no idea how to break the ice conversation-wise with apes, and so I knew that she did not like cats but did like dogs, and that she was a mother, and I'm a mother. And so I had brought pictures of my dogs and my kids to show her, and so I showed her a picture of my dogs and nothing, nada. And then I showed her a picture of my kids, and they were much younger at the time, and they were all in a bubble bath, and she punched into her lexicon board, babies washing bubbles. And it was from then on, we were talking. It was just sort of this this wonderful icebreaker, and then Pambinacia and I just really clicked.
And you've described that as an incredibly powerful moment for you. What changed in you with that exchange?
Well, imagine having a two-way conversation with an innate. It's really, you know, even though I've read about it and I've even watched it on video, and I talked to the linguists who are studying this at York University, it's very different to read about it and see footage of it and to have a conversation with an ape who will segue from asking you if you had a boiled egg for breakfast to requesting the return of the Easter Bunny.
The novel takes a lot of surprising twists and turns, and I don't want to give too much away, but within the first few pages, things have changed dramatically for the apes and for all of the people involved in their lives. And the apes actually end up as part of a reality television show. Can you describe that for us?
Sure. Well, one of the parts of bonobo culture that's different than other great apes is that they're extremely amorous, and they in their social groups, there's female-female bonding as the most intense friendships, and they have very common physical displays of affection. And so this group in the book tries to take advantage of that in a reality TV show situation.
So actually trying to display the sexual practices of bonobos as a way to titillate the public.
Well, I think he was hoping for the ape version of Jersey Shore.
What was the show like? This is the show within the book that's called Ape House. What did it end up being like?
Well, the apes did indeed continue their amorous activities, but unlike Jersey Shore, there were no conflicts, and there was no backstabbing, and they try to ratchet things up, and they try to make the apes misbehave. And I mean, in the end, the apes are the most civilized characters in the book, and you know, is Ape House the TV show with the apes on it, or is Ape House what was going on outside of Ape House?
And you really do try to draw a distinction between the fact that the bonobos are so peaceful and loving and that human beings are not.
Well, we, for many years, I think a large segment of people have said, explained away organized warfare and violence and so on, and said that we can't help it. It's hardwired into us, just as it is into chimpanzees. And now we have this other species that we know about who is just as closely related to us and does not have these issues in their culture. And so it gives us a different model of behavior to look at. And at one point in the book, John Thigpen and his wife are driving to a family wedding, and they pass a store sign that says guns and waffles. And that really kind of sums up the human condition. It's, do we know what side is going to pop up at which time? Do we have any control over it? And you know, we're not simply chimps, and we're not simply bonobos, and we're not simply a combination of the two. And it's just an interesting. I just think that that culture, that model of behavior, is a really interesting addition to an intelligent look at ourselves.
Sarah Gruen is the author of Ape House, and the novel features a family of bonobos that is loosely based on a group of bonobos that live at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. In just a few minutes, we'll continue our conversation with Sarah, and we'll also be talking with William Fields. He's the director of scientific research at the Great Ape Trust, and we'd love to hear from you as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and you're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. And my guest today is Sarah Gruen. She is the author of the new novel Ape House, and she was inspired in writing about the bonobos, who are at the center of the plot of that book, by a family of bonobos that resides in Des Moines at the Great Ape Trust. And the Great Ape Trust was founded in 2002. The first primate residents moved in 2004. And William Fields is the scientific director of the Great Ape Trust. Hello, William.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We've been talking a little bit about the language research done with bonobos at the Great Ape Trust, but what other kinds of things are being done there?
Language is a complex thing, and there are many types of... What is very interesting about studying language is that you have to use language to study it. And so we are looking at memory. We look at how language is acquired. What it takes to pass on the cultural dimensions of language. So it's simply just not about language. It is about how we tangibly live each day, and those circumstances are what give rise to the kinds of of symbolic capacities that Kanzi and his family are capable of producing.
Reading about the research that has been done with bonobos and language is fascinating, but what can we learn about human beings from that research?
Well, Kanzi is very different from a free-ranging bonobo. He's very different from his mother, Matata, who was wild caught. If Kanzi is able to do the kinds of things that he is able to do, which are quite extraordinary, he is a symbolic organism. He acquired language. He didn't learn language. He acquired language, just like a human child would. If Kanzi is able to do the kinds of things he can do through early rearing experience, what does this mean for human rearing, for the human condition?
Sue Savage Rumbaugh moved her bonobo research from Georgia State University when the Great Ape Trust was created in Des Moines. And we have a moment of audio here from, it was actually from a video that's on your website, that demonstrates that Kanzi can not only communicate through symbols and through sign language, but he can understand the spoken word. And here's that audio.
Okay, Kanzi's ready.
Kanzi, can you find egg? Egg.
Egg. Okay, let me look at my card. Good job. Good job.
M&M's.
M&M's. Okay, let me look. M&M's. Good job. Okay, Kanzi's ready.
Apple. Apple.
Apple.
Okay, let me look. Apple. Good job. Okay, Kanzi's ready.
Find Austin. Austin.
Let me look. Austin, good job. Wait now, let's do one more and then we'll have some bubble gum. Okay. Okay, Kanzi's ready.
Blackberries.
Blackberries.
Let me look. Good job, blackberries.
And that is a little bit of audio from an experiment that Sue Savage Rumbaugh, who is located now at the Great Ape Trust, was doing with Kanzi, one of the bonobos at the Trust, demonstrating that he understands the spoken word and then can communicate back through symbols what he has understood. And I have to ask you, because there was the mention of M&M's and there was the mention of bubblegum, and all throughout Sarah's book, the bonobos eat a lot of junk food. William, is that a concern that the bonobos have a real sweet tooth?
They do have a sweet tooth, but they don't eat a lot of junk food. The bonobos have an exceedingly high-quality diet of proteins and high-quality fat, olive oil. These special prestige items that you see featured in the research are rare. We have these on holidays or when visitors like Sarah come to visit or during the research. But most of the time, they are eating their vegetables and their fish and their chicken and their raw nuts. And so they have an extremely good diet.
And Sarah, in your book, you have a moment in the time of these bonobos where they are allowed to eat anything they want, and they do, most of them, gravitate toward junk food. Why did you want to demonstrate how similar they are to us in that way?
Well, I had actually just recently read about how people tend to order greasy, horrible junk food immediately after watching commercials about greasy, horrible junk food. And they've been done by food stylists so that the meat is glistening and it's, you know, it's falling gracefully through the air. And these bonobos have free access to television and, of course, can order anything they want from the computer and within Ape House. And so that was more of a statement of the power of advertising and perhaps the images that are embedded therein.
William, if I were to visit the Great Ape Trust, what is the facility like?
It's very large. It's modern. Sue and I designed it. We designed it to accommodate the human interaction between bonobos and visitors who would be new to our environment. It's also designed on ape side, if you will, for those of us who have direct contact with apes and to live in sort of a normal social environment between humans and apes, and to try to create that experience for the visitor who is there briefly who doesn't have direct contact.
Bonobos are an endangered species. Is there a concern about using them, even though this is obviously a very gentle kind of research and the bonobos are well cared for and seem to be very happy? Is there a concern about using them for research at all, considering that the species is endangered?
There's a positive concern. I believe our research significantly informs the future welfare of bonobos. One of the programs that we have in North America is species survival plans. And the question would be, if we are able to create groups of bonobos, and let's say that they do go extinct in the wild and that we have the opportunity to repatriate bonobos, how would you do that? I believe that with our research, where you have the researchers have a common bias with our population of bonobos, we have a greater opportunity to reintroduce great apes to the wild than if we were keeping them in captivity at some other social distance.
John is on the line in Mason City. Hello, John.
Yes. Good morning.
What's your question?
Well, I'm curious about the development of the bonobos, and it seems like if they're so well evolved that they speak amongst themselves and understand our language and as someone described two languages, it seems to me that that's somewhat cruel to keep them in captivity. It's almost like imprisoning them for being, you know, as good as they are rather than for some criminal act. But I'd like to hear a comment about that.
William, can you respond to that?
Our facility is designed to mitigate the effects of captivity. I think that the bonobos don't have the feeling of captivity. I think they love their home. They love their bedroom. They like their colony room. They like their greenhouse. They like their kitchen. They like to be able to go into my office. They like to travel. I think they have more freedom than, let's say, someone who lives in New York City in a high-rise. They have lots of room, and they have choices about where they move. They are not free-ranging apes, but nor would they want to be. I think living in Africa would be something that would be foreign to Kanzi in Pamanesia and in Yoda. It might be frightening. They live a high-quality life, and they enjoy being in their building, particularly during a thunderstorm or when it starts getting dark. They're ready to go back in to the house. That's where they want to be. So they are not aware of captivity, as the question would suggest.
John, thank you so much for your call. And Sarah, in your book, in a way, when you describe the facility, your fictitious facility that was based on the Great Ape Trust, you talk about the fact that many of the protections that seem to keep the apes captive are also there to keep them safe from human beings.
Yes, the bonobos are entirely sure that the moat and electric fence that surrounds their play yard is there to keep cats and people out, not bonobos in.
Do bonobos not like cats?
I know that Pam Venetia doesn't like cats. I can't speak for all bonobos, though.
I remember the story about Coco and her kittens, and she was not a bonobo. But so I didn't know if maybe there was naturally an affinity between felines and apes.
I don't know. I do know that Coco likes her kittens, and I'll ask the other bonobos today if they like cats, but I know Pam Venetia doesn't.
When you visited with the bonobos at the Great Ape Trust, did you get a feeling for their sense of contentment or happiness?
They are really in control. I mean, as in terms of living among humans, they have as much autonomy and choice over their surroundings as is possible.
William, bonobos are endangered. What are the pressures that have brought them to the edge of extinction?
Humans. It is simply humans exploiting the environment, which is normal. That's what humans do. But their habitat is being destroyed. And this is going to cause not only bonobos, but all great apes in the wild to go extinct.
Mark from Des Moines has a question. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have not read Ms. Gruen's book, but it sounds fascinating. The image that she has described this morning is that the bonobos present a very peaceful image that humans ought to emulate. And my understanding from some information that I've had through my work is that, in fact, the bonobos can be quite violent. And, in fact, that they use biting as a way of maintaining the hierarchy, and that, in fact, the caretakers have oftentimes had to deal with this violence. In fact, Mr. Fields, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I understand you're missing a digit in one of your hands because of an attack by a bonobo. Would either you or Ms. Gruen like to comment on that?
Bites are part of our cultural world. Bites are communicative. There have been violent bites, I imagine. I've never been involved in violent bites, but I imagine the fact that I may have lost a finger seems violent to others. I have to tell you that it's using teeth is just a cultural dimension that was imported through Matata. But if you get to an organism like Inyota, a bonobo that I've known since he is born, Inyota doesn't do that kind of thing. It's true that Kanji and Pamanisha both have used communicative biting, but I don't see it as particularly violent. But as we get into third and fourth generation bonobos, we see the whole issue of using teeth in those communicative fashions diminishing.
How about
so it's a function of culture.
In the wild, amongst bonobo groups, are there violent conflicts?
All primates negotiate politics. Bonobos are particularly political, just like chimpanzees. There are going to be physical mechanisms of which you negotiate those things. I think the issue is of the kinds of violence that you see like in chimpanzee cultures and that you see in human culture is what you do not see in bonobo culture.
So if I, and Sarah, maybe you can answer this one as well. If I were observing a group of bonobos and seeing their gentle interactions with each other or their regular interactions with each other, what would I observe that would give me the idea that these are peaceful, loving creatures?
Well, for one thing, they wouldn't be fighting. For another, they'd probably be having sex. And for a third, they'd probably be sharing food.
And also, how do they interact with their babies or their offspring?
Oh, they're the babies are perhaps at the top of the social hierarchy, which is really very different from obviously chimpanzee culture, where the males kill the infants in order to bring the female back into estrus and bear their own child. There is some controversy over whether this is what really happened. But one of the theories is that because the bonobos are all having sexual contact with each other, no male knows what baby is his and therefore doesn't care. And so there's no infanticide.
And we want to ask about sex and bonobos because they are one of the few species on Earth, along with human beings and I believe, is it dolphins?
Yes.
That enjoy having sexual intercourse and just do it for recreational purposes, not for procreational purposes. But this is, how often do bonobos engage in sexual acts?
To my knowledge, the average captive bonobo initiates some kind of contact every hour and a half, approximately.
And when we talk about contact, this is not only with each other, male, female, but female, female, and they also masturbate.
It's every possible conceivable form.
William, what do we know about this? Why do you think bonobos are such sexual creatures?
Well, I think as bonobos use their teeth for communication, I believe that they also use their genitalia in ways that are not always it may look like sex to us. And it's certainly the case that bonobos have sex and they have recreational sex, but they also use their genitalia very much like we would use our hands when people shake hands. Bonobos often use their genitalia to greet. And I know that ethologists who have observed bonobos in the wild may have not been able to make the distinction between what is sexual and what would be another social use of genitalia.
I want to get back to one of the questions that we have about language. We have a question from Jess on Twitter. How will the linguistics research at the Great Ape Trust impact the way we teach our children second languages?
We have not looked at second language acquisition other than to indicate that first language acquisition is very, very different. That is that it is not possible to learn a second language unless you have acquired language during the window between 0 and 4 years of age. If you're not exposed to language during that critical period, it's not possible to acquire language later on. So to have a second language, you have to have a first language. So second language is not directly informed by our research. Our research is about that initial enculturation, that acquisition of language and culture.
So possibly it would have more impact when we're talking about children who have profound hearing loss and need to acquire a language, or autistic children.
Or any language delay pathology.
All right. We'll talk about that more in a moment. My guests today are Sarah Gruen, who is the author of the new novel Ape House, and also William Fields, the director of scientific research at the Great Ape Trust. You can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. With me today are Sarah Gruen. She's the author of the new book, Ape House, as well as three other novels. And the center of her book is a family of bonobos who communicate through American Sign Language and symbols and can also understand spoken language. Also with us today is William Fields. He's the director of scientific research at the Great Ape Trust. And the family of bonobos at the Great Ape Trust is the family that inspired this family in the novel, Ape House. We'd love for you to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we got an email from Molly in Des Moines, and she said that she got into her car to hear our program just in time to hear Sarah talking about her experience, that first conversation that you had with an ape who was also a mother. And hearing this makes me cry when I think of an ape like her being used for any sort of research that causes harm or pain. More and more, it seems we have evidence that animals have some sort of conscience and emotion. How do we get around the ethical issues surrounding research and captivity? Again, that's from Molly in Des Moines. And William, I know at the Great Ape Trust that you don't participate in any research that causes these apes harm. But can we talk for a moment about the ethics of using primates, bonobos, and other kinds of primates in research that would be harmful?
There certainly has been a history of difficult research with primates in research, and one of the goals of our research has been to move away from that. It's not that the bonobos might be conscious. There is no question they are conscious. They are individuals. They're persons. While they're not human, they are autobiographical. They have an understanding of the past, present, and the future. And they live in a world in which we have designed to accommodate them specifically. Therefore, there is not any type of suffering that occurs in our lab. Whether that kind of suffering with primates in research goes on in the world, it's not high profile anymore. I believe our research has significantly informed these issues and had an impact upon using primates, particularly in biomedical research. So I think Kanzi and Paminisha's living in captivity, which some may see as unnatural for bonobos, has had a huge impact for other primates.
Sarah, in your book, there are people for plot reasons that do this kind of really painful and invasive research on primates. In researching your book, what did you find out about those kind of organizations?
The lab scenes, the bad things that happen to some apes in my book are historically accurate. And although I have taken the fiction writer's liberty of fudging dates and names, those were the sorts of things that did and may still be continuing to be done to some primates. And it shouldn't be. The Air Force chimps, for example, when they got back from outer space, the astronauts got ticker tape parades and the Air Force chimps went into biomedical research. And I think that that's something that people may not be aware of and should be. I think that we need to rethink how we treat our closest cousins.
Rick is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Rick.
Good morning. I guess I have two questions. The first is, are there centers like the Great Big Center in Des Moines in other parts of the world, Europe in that area? And if there are, this is the stranger part of the question. Even with AMSWAM as the communication device, would say if there was a center in France, would it pick up? Would the bonobos pick up some of the French culture as opposed to the American culture? And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Rick. William?
We are the only organization that does research with bonobos in the world that I am aware of. And I don't believe that there is any organization that is does the kind of work that we do. With respect to the ability of our apes to use their Alexagram keyboard with other apes, the whole issue of receptive competence and productive competence with symbols is something that is acquired during rearing. What Kanzian, Pamanician, and Yoda and Tico are able to do, I'm not sure that a French chimpanzee who might be living in a zoo would be able to communicate with them. So the whole issue of the way cultural memes move back and forth between social groups would be possible because there's no common bias. The French chimpanzee just simply would not have the receptive and productive competence with symbols that Kanzian, Pamanician, and Yoda and Tico have.
But if, from reading Sarah's book, and maybe you can comment on this, Sarah, it certainly seems like the bonobos that you write about are steeped in American culture, wouldn't you say?
Well, they are thrust into American culture in the TV show. They have, but it's a statement. I'm contrasting human behavior and bonobo behavior and kind of having a look at how humans treat humans in this book and having a look at tabloid journalism, the world of Facebook and Twitter, and how we have all of this instant data available to us that makes us feel on one level as though we have some kind of intimate knowledge of people who are celebrities or people who are celebutantes, and the difference being people with talent and people who put out sex tapes. But it's very easy to be bad to each other from behind the anonymous keyboard. You would say things. People say things to each other that they would never say face to face. And it also gives us enough distance to revel in the downfall of these people. And that's simply a part of our human culture at this particular moment in time.
The apes in your book enjoy watching television, and they enjoy watching television when they're in the research facility, although they get to watch a great deal more television once they get thrust into this world of reality television. William, do the apes at the Great Ape Trust get to watch TV?
They do watch television, but they don't watch program television. Everything that we allow them to see is highly edited. Now, Pamanisha would just love to watch Jurassic Park over and over and over again. She loves things with big monsters and dinosaurs. But Kanzi would much prefer to watch something sweet that has birds tweeting that's really nice. And Yoda likes Harry Potter. So we are very selective about what we let them watch. For example, Harry Potter has lots of things in it that we might not want them to try to do. So we are very careful about what we let them watch. They do not watch program television, though.
Do you get a sense from them what their level of comprehension is when they watch a film like Harry Potter?
Well, and Yoda certainly has a high level of comprehension, because when bad things happen to Harry Potter, they are responding to it. They don't like it. But I think what's more interesting is that we have had caretakers who actually read to them from Harry Potter, and they become very upset. And so when bad things happen, so we have sort of read from Harry Potter in an edited manner in which we don't read the bad parts. And we just read the good parts.
There are so many parallels to parenting when we've talked about junk food and television and editing out violence. So it sounds like you have to be very careful with your bonobos.
And we are.
What? I know that the Great Ape Trust has programs in place around the world to try to support bonobos in the wild. What kind of work are you doing to try to keep this species alive and free?
Well, we have always supported bonobo conservation, either through the Japanese work or through the Congolese work. And currently we are supporting the peace forest that has been initiated by Sally Cox. And what we believe is probably the best thing to do is to preserve habitat. And if you can preserve habitat, then we have an opportunity to preserve the bonobo species.
I know that with many primates, there's still a black market trade in their hands or in their heads, and you know there is a poaching culture that continues. Is that a problem for the bonobos?
Yes, it's a problem. Bushmeat is a significant problem in Africa. There's a protein shortage in Africa. People need food, and it's a complicated question. When you get to Africa and you try to do conservation, one of the first things that human beings will ask you is, do you care more about apes than you do humans? And the answer to that is no, we don't. But the whole issue of how you begin to rearrange the culture and how one tangibly lives every day is a complicated issue. So bushmeat, which is a normal activity among people who live in Central Africa, is not easy to mitigate. The real problem has been the free market that has come to bushmeat, that people who are harvesting primates to sell, we do chicken or beef or in our meat industry here in North America. That is the real problem. If we could remove the market forces, we might be able to just tolerate a certain level of bushmeat activity.
Sarah, Ape House is an exciting novel. There's a lot going on, and a lot going on surrounding these apes, although personally I just loved the descriptions of how the apes interacted with each other, and I learned a lot about bonobos from the book. So clearly you want people to have a good time reading the book, but what else do you want to make sure they take away from it?
I would like people to think about how we treat each other, how we might do that differently. And I also really, this sounds old-fashioned, but I just really want to provide a good read.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You have a blurb on the back of your book from someone who had written a scientific book about bonobos. And I don't have it right in front of me, but she said something along the lines of that your novel had already done more for bonobos than she ever could. Do you hope that people will really learn something about bonobos from having a good read that involves them?
I do, and her name is Vanessa Woods, and she has a book out called Bonobo Handshake, which is nonfiction, and it's really, really good, and I recommend people read it. You'll learn a lot about bonobos. She works in the Congo with the Loloya Bonobo Sanctuary, which takes the babies who are orphaned from the bushmeat trade and rehabilitates them, and when they are ready, puts them back into the jungle.
William, again, there have been a number of books written about bonobos, nonfiction books, and scientific research done. And, of course, a lot of people have paid a lot of attention to the research done at the Great Ape Trust. What do you think having a popular novel can do for bonobos that maybe some of that scientific research can't do?
Well, there are many things that literature does that facts cannot do. And I think that there is a truth associated with the facts here that are liberated by the literature. I believe that the reader of Sarah's book can begin to have an emotional feel for what our life is like and how happy it is and how much fun it is, and that it is a normal life. And of course, the book has dramatic moments in it, and it's exciting to read the book. And we have thought about whether we are going to read this book to Kanzi and Pamanisha and Inyota or not, because there are parts of it that are very scary. But I think that Sarah points out some very important things about the world, and it is that we have to understand one another. And in understanding one another, I think that we get to a point where we can live together. And that is what bonobos do. That is what I see is the major difference between bonobo culture and human culture. You can have lots of bonobos living together very, very peacefully. Chimpanzees don't do that. Humans do it in a sort of chimpanzee bonobo-like kind of mosaic way. And I think that if we can get to the point where we can really communicate and understand one another, we can begin to solve the major problems that face our species.
Sarah, the novel is dedicated to Pamanisha, one of the bonobos at the Great Ape Trust, the one that we talked about earlier, where you really felt that you connected with her because you were both mothers. Does she know that the book is dedicated to her?
Yes, she does. She certainly does.
How did
she
respond?
We had a tea party to celebrate. We had a tea party. She invited me to have a tea party, and we did. And I read her part of the manuscript, and I showed her the dedication page, and she pointed to her name. So she's well aware.
Why did you dedicate the book to her?
Because she was the one I'm most connected with, and that's just why. I mean, I haven't had an opportunity to personally know very many great apes, and she's my close friend.
Will you get an opportunity to see the apes again while you're in Des Moines?
I'm going there right now.
What are you most hoping that you'll get to do or say to the apes today?
Well, I'm bringing green apples, and we'll just see what they feel like talking about.
Now, your first two books revolved around horses, your third around an elephant, and now bonobos. Are you working on another novel?
I have something percolating, but I don't want to say too much about it yet because my writing process is very organic, and so if I say something now, when the book comes out in 3 years, whatever I just said won't be in it. So.
All right. Does it involve another species?
It will, yes.
Why is that so important to you to write about animals?
It also happens sort of organically because I have a house full of decrepit rescued animals, and if I'm going to spend 8 hours in a fictional world, I'd rather have animals in it.
Sarah Gruen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And William Fields, thank you.
You're welcome.
William Fields is the Director of Scientific Research at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. Sarah Gruen is a novelist. Her fourth novel, which just came out this week, is called Ape House. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Sarah McCammon in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at all times on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And you can send us email anytime. Let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what you'd like to hear on the show. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, caring for loved ones with dementia. I'll talk with Karen Stobie, who travels the country sharing what she learned from caring for her father who had Alzheimer's disease. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.